Hi, everyone. My name is Jared Lank, and this is the Center for Tribes podcast. Our guest today is Arctalo Santa Moore, or Tay for short, who is a neurodivergent, autistic, queer, and trans, gender nonconforming person of Mexican indigenous descent who deeply believes in active listening and the power of holistic affirmation and self-agency. Tay has spent over a decade in the nonprofit field, working with organizations throughout Chicago, New York, Vermont, California, and Michigan, centering justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion practices, and using trauma-informed and intersectionality-based frameworks. Today, they serve as a national speaker, trainer, and educator, and as the executive director of Youth Move National. Tay's work ensures people are seen, validated, and celebrated for being themselves. A significant component of this work is enabling folks to understand their identities and lived experiences so individuals can honor their holistic and authentic selves as they work to liberate themselves and others from the systems that seek to prevent that. In our conversation, Tay and I discussed the tools in a recent three-part webinar series they developed in collaboration with the Center for Tribes. The webinar, Decolonizing the History of the Gender Binary, equips professionals in the tribal child welfare field with practical and empathetic approaches to supporting gender-diverse Indigenous youth. We at the Center for Tribes hope you enjoy this wonderful conversation with Tay and encourage you to watch the recorded three-part webinar series if you haven't already. All content and tools discussed in this episode will be listed in the show notes and are available on our website, tribalinformationexchange.org. Hey, Tay, welcome to the pod.
Yeah, oh my gosh, thank you for having me. I'm so excited. What is this? Is this season two, right?
Yeah, season two. Season two, episode one. So you're the inaugural guest for season
two. Wow, let's go. All right, let's do it.
I know, right? It's amazing. So I thought before we get started today, you could just let the people know a little bit about yourself, who you are, what you do, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I appreciate that. So hello, I am Arctalo Santa Moore, which can be a long name, so most folks call me Tay. My mandatory pronouns are they, them, there. And I would say I do a lot of different things, but for the sake of, I think, our conversation today, I'm a queer and trans educator. I've worked in sort of the education facilitator, presenter, sort of sex ed realm, really, if you will. Maybe for the past 10 or so, maybe 10 plus years. I'm also do nonprofit management, so I'm the executive director of Youth Move National, and then I also own my own consulting company, which is Arctalos Consulting. And yeah, just super excited to be here and talk with you, Jared.
Great, yeah, thank you so much. I just want to say, first of all, before we get into everything, that the webinar series we did together, you know, the three-part, was just an incredible experience, and we've had so much feedback that it's been invaluable to people in their practice and what they're doing to help support the youth. So I just want to say huge thank you from the Center for Tribes for the work you've done for us so far. And I'm excited to dive into it a little bit in the podcast so that we can really talk about how your lived experience informs this work and how you kind of get into it and help people in this work. So thank you so much for that.
Yeah, gosh, of course. I mean, it was really a pleasure to do the series. And I think that, you know, from a trainer facilitator standpoint, I'm always like wanting to be true to the material and to kind of present it in my, you know, unique individual way. But yeah, of course, the whole point is that it resonates with folks and folks take something from it. And so I'm really glad to hear that feedback that it sounds like, from what I'm hearing, things went good. There was positive feedback.
Incredibly good. Yeah, no, it's been a profound
awesome
work, and I'm excited to see the focus group work, to see how people take this and kind of share with one another about everything. So I think it's going to go phenomenally well. We're looking forward to even more of that feedback in the future as people get to access this ongoing. So thank you so much. And I was wondering, too, since we're kind of going to talk today about each part of the webinar, if we could, before that, talk a little bit more about your lived experience. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about what got you into this work, a little bit more about how you got into the consulting work you do today and the company that you're kind of operating that does this work as a nonprofit. So if you could dive into that a little bit, it'd be great.
Yeah, of course. Oh my gosh. I will try to emphasize the little bit because I think that could be a 7-hour conversation in and of itself.
Yeah.
So I will say, from the sort of lived experience realm, or even just to name a few identities, right? So I am queer, I'm demipansexual, I'm trans, non-binary, gender fluid, two-spirit, I'm a person of color, right? I'm Mexican indigenous. So specifically, my tribal nation is I'm Coatecan. Our folks are from southern Texas, northeast Mexico. We're not an officially federally recognized tribe. And I know that that can be a whole other podcast in of its own right with what that means and colonial language and pan-indigenous terms around even just being Coatecan. So I'm sure that's its own thing. And yeah, I'm someone who, gosh, grew up, I would say, not under the best circumstances. So someone who definitely is a victim survivor of trauma and abuse. I'm someone who has definitely experienced the wide range of interpersonal and systemic oppression just from being a person of color and being queer and trans. And, you know, I hold serious co-occurring mental illness, you know, so I have that sort of stigma that can sometimes follow that. But all of that, I think, to me, is really, which I think is a privilege to say at this point, but it's an honor to have learned to be in right relations with all of that. I think that's really what I tried to hold both personally and professionally, is how do I take all of my lived experience, be in right relationship with it, right? So not shy away from it, not push it away, not dislike it or try to solve it or to fix it, but just to be in right relationship with it. And then how do I leverage that to make changes, right? To make a tangible, better world. And I think my little slice of that is to utilize that to do trainings, to do facilitations, to do education around really trying to push folks, even if it's just like a centimeter, a millimeter further along on their social justice journey. I think that's what really drives me. You know, I learned very early on that systemic oppression is real and it's going to happen, you know? And so I think my take on it was not to necessarily to succumb to it, but to recognize it and then utilize it to channel like my tangible change to it, to channel difference through. And I think I do that in a lot of my work. And I appreciate you bringing it up. I think mainly my consulting business, Arctelos Consulting, you know, we've been running in some way, shape, or form probably for the past 10 years plus, but really have started to take off in the most recent years. And essentially, I just get to do cool series like the one that we just did for y'all, right? And I get to travel the nation and do conferences and keynotes and presentations and trainings. I do like multiple day workshops. I do 1 hour long get togethers. I just do the whole range of things all on various social justice topics. But again, I think my sort of core that I focus in is on the 2S LGBTQI plus community, since it's just a core portion of who I am and the work I do. So I hope that makes sense. I hope that gets to a little bit, I think, of what you were looking for. But I'm here. I've got the time. So you ask me questions. Let's do it.
I think that that's incredible. And, you know, I think in this work in particular, there's so much value to be added when we can learn from our own lived experiences, like what you're talking about, and bring that to the table and champion the experience as a way to inform how we teach other people about how to work through this and navigate it on an individual level, right? Like so much of what we're working inside of today is a system that is utilitarian in focus, right? It's very much focused on the most outcomes for the most people, but the way that we inform it as individuals through lived experience is so powerful on the individual level, for not only for the people that are being helped through the system, but also for, you know, the people working inside of the system to help those people that need it the most. So I feel like, you know, part of the reason it's so impactful to have someone such as yourself do a webinar series for the center in particular is because you are approaching the work not from a perspective of coming in, I see the problem and this is how we fix it, but you're coming in to say, this is how I experience things and this is how I relate to this work and this is how we can center the voices of those that aren't at this table right now, because I can in some ways champion the idea of what they represent and how this work impacts them beyond this theoretical kind of higher level thinking of how to fix it from a systemic level.
Yeah.
So I really value how you bring that to the table and how you, again, champion your lived experience and use it as a tool to help other people. It's profoundly impactful and profoundly effective in this work in particular.
Yeah, gosh, I appreciate that. Yeah, and I know that I'm very, very intentional around that, and I hope that that comes across in the videos during the series. You know, I think one of the first things I say at the beginning of all three of them is that, like, I'm not an expert. Like, the only thing I'm an expert at is myself. You know, like, of course, I'm bringing in my professional experience, I'm bringing in my education, I'm bringing in a wide range of knowledge and research and sort of like breadth of information. But at the same time, like you said, I'm really channeling that and presenting it through my own perspective, my own lens, my own lived experience, because that's the only thing, one, I feel truly comfortable talking about. And then two, it's really, again, the only thing I'm an expert on, especially when we're talking about the issues that we talked about throughout this series, right? Really talking about 2SLGBTQI plus identity, talking about how to engage within like youth and child tribal welfare. All of that is so like individual to each unique person and each unique community. And the last thing I want to do is champion other identities or communities, one, I don't belong to, and two, shouldn't really be speaking on behalf of. So I really try to approach this work giving, yes, broad knowledge, yes, bringing in all of those components, giving folks tools to sort of progress on their social justice journey. But like you said, really trying to do it from a perspective of like, this is really just me. And it's the things I've experienced. It's the things I want to share. I'm using I statements. You know, you're not getting right answers. You're getting Tay answers. And I find that that really, I think, has served me well in this work. And I think also helps me from going too broad or going into areas that I think is really not my place to go into. You know, I'm a big believer in folks having the agency to self-identify. You know, like, I know there's sometimes this old like adage of like, oh, I got to speak for others like who can't speak up. And I find that most of the time, no, actually, they are speaking up. They're speaking for themselves. You're speaking over them. So really always wanting to be intentional about the areas in which I take up space and the areas in which I intentionally don't take up space. And that sort of tool that I use is that lived experience lens.
I absolutely love that perspective. I think that that is so, so important in any facet of work that involves helping others, is that you don't want to create, you know, agency for yourself in a place that you maybe shouldn't be. And you should be allowing self-advocacy and self-representation as much as possible in order to be, you know, realistically the most effective at what you're trying to accomplish, right? Like, it is the most effective way to help those that need it is by allowing them to convey what they need, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think talking about the lived experience and how you bring that to the table brings up a really good transition into the first part of the webinar series, where you spent a lot of time setting the context and underlining the importance of that context for the rest of the webinar series about how to approach this work, right? I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the intentionality behind part one of the webinar and why you chose to set out in this contemporary framework of understanding for the work, and then how that informs part two and part three for the series. So if you could talk a little bit about that intentionality, I think that would be great.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think right off the bat, accessibility is really important to me, you know, and so even before we get to the title slide, even before we get to introductions, I'm always wanting to make sure that we walk through some of those accessibility pieces. And so I think there's a lot of intentionality behind there, right? So making sure the closed captions are set up, folks got that chat box open, there's open ways to communicate. We have an amazing team like you, Jared, who are there to moderate and to kind of do that tech support. You know, I go to a lot of these trainings and I find that like folks get like 5-10 minutes in before they're doing this piece, if they're doing it at all. And I'm like, well, then you're not really being accessible. You know, like folks who needed that accessibility have now not gained all 10 minutes before that point. And so I just think it's a really important thing to do right off the bat, really sort of, again, sort of level set around those accessibility needs and privacy needs. You know, like I know it was, we were in webinar mode, so it covered us. But when we're doing that recording, I want to make sure that everyone feels safe and their privacy is protected. So I do try to do a lot of intentionality to do those housekeeping items around accessibility and privacy, like before we even get to that title slide. And I know that the recording itself is something that I often shy away from, if you will, just knowing that, you know, I think as I presented in the series, it's just freezing a moment in time, you know, like it's capturing, I hope, hopefully a great moment in time, hopefully a knowledgeable, energetic, fun, great moment in time, but it's still frozen, you know, and I just think if we're not doing our due diligence to always be learning and growing and changing and adapting and like finding new current relevant resources, I feel like we're sort of like doing ourselves a disservice, myself included. You know, like I hope that we look back on these recordings 2-3 years from now and find that they're a little outdated, right? Because I hope we're learning. I hope we're growing. I hope we're progressing. And so I think doing some intentionality around that was also really important to me. And then I think broadly, just to go into my intentions around part one, it's really just that like level setting. Like I know that everyone is going to have a different entryway to this knowledge, to this work. You know, sometimes I say, you know, folks may be like 3 feet into their social justice journey, or they may be miles down the road. And so it's really sort of hard, I would say almost near impossible, to be everything to everyone. So often my technique is to focus on sort of what I would call that movable middle, right? You've got a certain percentage right up front, I think, who get it, who are knowledgeable, like this is going to be a repeat for them, but they're on board. And then maybe on the back end, you have a few folks that like aren't so knowledgeable intentionally, and maybe are not interested in necessarily learning more or growing in this direction. And so I think really focusing on, again, that what's in between, that movable middle, is the best way to go forward. And I think we can only do that if we share common definitions, if we share common foundations of knowledge. And so doing that part one sort of helps us all level set as a group, sort of as a cohort going through the series, to have all of that knowledge first. Because again, I know folks are going to define these in different ways. Folks are going to have different entry points. So being able to do that as a group, whether you've heard the terms before or haven't, I just think like really helps us move forward with that intentionality, with that like careful, you know, sort of priming with intention method. So I'm glad that you picked up on it, and I hope it came across through all of the series, not just even the first one.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's incredible the way that you approached the consenting around recording and how you approached just the topic in general for part one, just how you kind of set the context for everything and allowed people to kind of get in the headspace of understanding, you know, what we're going to work through. It's really important, and I feel like it's not approached in such a meaningful way nowadays in general with these more remote Zoom things. Like you said, so many people wait 5-10 minutes into a call, and it just kind of changes how we perceive it and how we end up experiencing the entirety of a webinar or something that we should be, you know, really focused on.
Yeah.
One thing I really liked in part one of the webinar series was your use of different tools and different models to kind of set this framework out for the audience to understand the work that we're going to be doing through the rest of the webinar, and also for them to refer back to in this kind of recursive way of understanding the work that they're going to be engaging with, right? One of them in particular I found really fascinating was the SIEO model. And I was wondering if you could explain that a little bit in your choice of implementing that and how it relates to other core concepts you put into part one, like intersectionality.
Yeah, for sure. And I love the SIEO model. So this model comes from Dr. Eli Green, wrote a great book called The Transgender Toolkit, also ran a company that I worked for a little bit called the Transgender Training Institute. And so it's just a model that I'm very, one, familiar with, and two, really love, because I think the model itself, I always say this, like, people are complex, right? Identity is complex, people is complex, lived experience is complex. But a lot of the concepts that we're talking about, I believe, are really sort of easy to understand if you break it down piece by piece. And that's really what I like about that SIEO model, is that I feel like it really breaks it down in a really granular way and sort of builds upon itself to get to that, again, sort of that core foundation of knowledge in order to sort of approach what can really be, for all intents and purposes, a really highly politicized, careful topic, right, that we need to be like engaging with, because we're talking about people and their lived experience and oppression and marginalization they experience from that identities in those communities. So I like how, again, that SIEO model takes complexity and doesn't try to get rid of the complexity, but breaks down piece by piece the foundations, so then when we welcome in that those folks' lived experience, that it translates a little bit better, And I think oftentimes when we're dealing with, so SIEO model is sex assigned at birth, gender identity, gender expression, and sexual orientation, that I find that in this field, oftentimes when folks hear all of those things, I think they immediately think of, queer and trans folks. They immediately think of the 2SLGBTQI plus community. And I think folks who aren't in that community have a tendency to then push it away, to be like, oh, I don't get it, I don't understand it, and I don't need to, it doesn't apply to me. And I think one of the reasons why it was important for me to do that sort of action plan that was in part one and in our tip sheet was to really be like, no, y'all, like, it actually applies to the vast majority of us. The vast majority of us have that sex assigned at birth that we can find on our birth certificate or state ID or driver's license or passport. We have a gender identity, right? We have a way in which, we inherently and instinctually know ourselves and our heart, mind, body, spirit, and soul. We have a way we express it, right? We, most of us, have names and pronouns and, fun little unique ways that we dress and like present ourselves. And, attractionality and sexual orientation, I think, applies to all of us, even if there's a lack thereof, even if there is not wanting to be in relationships with someone. So I like the model because, again, taking complexity, making it sort of approachable is a better way to phrase it. And two, I think it shows us that these concepts kind of apply to everybody. And so I think once folks know that, I think they're able to approach it better. I think they're able to like see how it applies to them and then try and engage with it a little bit more than they would have otherwise. And I'm glad and I hope that we did that action plan and folks are really engaging with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like you're doing such a good job with this webinar series and for the discussion right now, talking a lot about a topic that I think comes up a lot when you're talking about indigenous epistemology, right? And it's this idea that when you approach the subject of inclusion for indigenous people in any type of education, it often brings the person being taught into this part of their life that they may have never experienced before, where they are putting themselves directly inside of the curriculum. It implicates them on a personal level. And I think that for you in this webinar, you did a wonderful job approaching the topic of it doesn't relate to me, right? So, of this this concept of this is a vacuum topic, like it exists inside of a vacuum, right? This is a past tense. This is an othered topic in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I feel that the SIEO model was a wonderful way to say, let's get introspective here for a minute. Let's like really think about the subconscious biases I'm putting onto my own perceptions here, right? I'm not just operating under this ego to say everything that I think is definitive. For the first time, I'm recognizing through this model and through this, webinar series, this education on this topic, that I am directly implicated in this. And on top of that, I have a position that is very much movable and fluid. And that my understanding of it is rigid because of my potentially unwillingness to approach the topic previously. So I feel like tools like the SIEO model are really wonderful at enabling people to approach topics that they may have not approached before and allowing them to reflectively look at their perspective on something and say, this is where I'm at. This is how I understand things. And I've detached my ego from this understanding. And I've realized that a lot of these things that I'm operating under were given to me, right? They were put on me by something.
Yeah.
And I think it's so empowering to think I don't have to conform to this mold that someone else made for me, right? And I think that's really the core of what your education in this work is doing for someone like me, is saying, if I fit inside this kind of cis heteronormative umbrella, right? Like I'm a straight man and I conform to that, right? That doesn't mean that these things are rigid, right? That doesn't mean that my own understanding of myself is concrete, definitive, just because it's defined in a way, right?
Yeah.
So I really like that. And I really like how the SIEO model lends itself to the other topic areas of part one that say, you know, intersectionality and the concepts of trans-affirming that you really kind of baked in there, because it's saying, like, I guess what you're doing is you're humanizing it, right? You're saying, like, you are a human watching this. You are a human engaging with this work.
Yeah.
This work serves humans, right? We're all humans, and we're all deserving of that respect.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So should we go through the action plan? I know that we had talked about it.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, I mean, we're talking a lot about the SIEO model and the action plan and intentionality. So I feel like I want to put you on the spot and be like, Jared, did you do it? You know what I mean? Like,
I did. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I want to ask you these things. How was it? How was the process for you?
It was good. You know, it was something where, you know, I will admit that I consider myself a pretty progressive person, even though, like I was just saying, I fit inside of the idea of like a cis het man, right? Yeah. Like I am very much in this gender conformed like space for myself, right? But that being said, I have so many people in my life that don't conform to these like traditional Western binaries of gender, right? And I totally come from a place of wanting to understand it more. And just because I fit inside of one of the like assigned binaries of this system doesn't mean at all that I'm not understanding of them, right? But I think that what your webinar did for me and what this action sheet did was allowed me to really say, I think, you know, to be totally honest, I was very, not shut off, but I think to your point about part one and about the beginning of this conversation saying it doesn't apply to me, I never came from that perspective saying it doesn't apply to me, so I don't want to understand. I always said I want to understand because I feel like I don't fit inside of the representative group that needs this representation because they're not understood, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
for
yeah.
me to be able to go through the action plan, you know, it sounds almost embarrassing for me to say, and it's on the nose, but it's like I realize that just because I'm inside of that conformed kind of binary doesn't mean that I'm not represented in this work, right?
Yeah.
And it's you know, so I found it very insightful to drill down on my own concepts of self, even though I have confidence that I know that that's what I am and who I am authentically. I still found it very engaging and meaningful for me to go through it because it gave me this really empathetic insight into how this helps everybody by doing this type of work.
I really love what you just said, Jared, and how you sort of like set the foundation of that, because I think that that's really the intention, I think, is to realize that, you know, this gender binary that we have, right, is literally invented. It's not a real thing. It's a social construct that was invented by a specific group of folks to oppress another specific group of folks. And so, you know, it's essentially this invention that has been handed down and forced upon us. And I think one of the biggest things I just want people to do, besides recognizing that, is to then say, oh, well, I don't have to take their word for it. I don't have to take their invention. I actually only get to define myself. I'm the one who gets to, in a weird way, invent myself. And so I love how you sort of broke it down to say that, like, I was a part of that system. I understood that system. But when I thought about it, it was really like I'm really kind of discovering it for myself, right? That these are the things that you sort of know to be true to you and your heart, mind, body, spirit, and soul. And I think even if that fits in within the gender binary, or it even fits in within these stereotypes, there's a difference between now something have being forced upon you and you sort of discovering it for yourself to be like, oh, well, now I have ownership over it. Like, now I know it. And hopefully with that, then there's less rigidity, or then there's more movement for you to be like, well, maybe I can experiment a little bit if like it crosses my mind. And so I just like love how you sort of broke it down, because I think that's just what I want people to do, is to just realize it doesn't have to be this way for anyone or everyone, including me. And so how do I start to recognize who I am in my heart, mind, body, spirit, and soul, and not what others have been telling me I am? And even if you come to the same conclusion, cool, but you've done that work for yourself. And I just think it makes it all the more beautiful in order to express that and affirm it and to know it. So I appreciate you sharing that little intro to that.
The assumption that, or these like gender identity assumptions in this binary that we exist in, are so passively engaged in our life, right? Like they are something that just is, for lack of a better term, you're basically indoctrinated into. Like when you are born and part of a society that just accepts these as normal, you don't have to put in a lot of active work to be a part of that system, right? And that's how
Yeah, unless you don't fit into it.
unless you don't fit into it, right? And that's like what I think is so compelling about this work, is like that friction for people that don't conform to that is what prompts their need for action, right? And the passivity of people, such as myself, that fit inside the binary is like, yeah, it just feels normal because it is normal. That's really not the case, right? Like it should be active work because it's self-liberating to engage with this work, like you said, and really learn about yourself instead of being told who you are and what you are, right? Like I think that that is like such a core takeaway for me from this work, is that just because you may feel like you fit inside of this normalized binary doesn't mean that you're not part of this work in general. And that doesn't mean that you should shy away from the work, because the work itself is very self-liberating and self-introspective in a way that will fuel your growth. It'll make you a more understanding person of yourself and be able to convey yourself better to others, right? And I think that that's so important.
Totally. And I think even you just using the word sort of like normal or normalize, I think begs the question of like, as defined by who? You know what I mean? And so like really
Yeah, totally.
questioning all of those, like when we're socialized to something, we're socialized to the, like you said, to the point where we don't even notice it anymore. It is normalized to where like I don't realize that gender is like basically in everything, because like I fit within that pre-described or pre-subscribed normal. I've
Exactly.
never had to ask these questions of myself or deal with it. And so I think that's a big part of it too, is building critical thinking skills, is to ask why, is to question, is to think about why is that the normal? And if that is the normal, who is it marginalizing? Who is it valuing over who it's invaluing? Who benefits from that normal and who doesn't benefit from that normal? And really sort of recognizing that, like, a normal should be to like individuals. What's normal to us? You know what I mean? There should be normal, no normal, quote unquote, sexual orientation. It should just be like literally whatever people's sexual orientation is normal to them. And that should be celebrated and affirmed and embraced, instead of there being, again, like this very binary system that we've all been sort of like forced into. So yeah, I appreciate you bringing up that word normalized, because I think that socialization is a big part of this conversation. and breaking that cycle of critical thinking, asking why, noticing it, you know what I mean? Sometimes it can be like night and day after you've had these things to start to be like, oh, wow, okay, I see that. It's actually in this language. They're asking the question here. It's in a pronoun here. Why is it here?
Absolutely.
Why is the, you know, the razor pink only for women? And then there's like pink toolkits. Why? Why is that? And starting to see it and question it, I really hope that it expands people's mind, and I hope it's like a whole new world.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, I think that this is summed up well. Again, it's so parallel to the indigenous, you know, activism work and general inclusion work, because a huge term that or phrase that I incorporate into the work that I do a lot is that inaction is action, right? Like by being inactive, you are being very active and perpetuating something passively, right? And so, you know, for representation, for your own growth, all that, and I feel like that is so foundational to this webinar series, is that like this is a moment for you to reclaim that self-empowerment, to say I have a choice on what I'm putting out there. I'm not just allowing someone to make me feel conformed and I'm just feeding into that. I know the decision I'm making, and I know how that informs who I am as a person. Part two of the series really does focus on the history of the gender binary and how you approach decolonization and the need for it in the contemporary, right, in today's world, how that history is the lead up to the circumstances we find ourselves in today. And, you know, I really appreciated how you approached the history in particular, because so much of Native history and work and education around that is complex and heavy. But you did a really excellent job kind of navigating that and leading with, the intentionality of saying this informs today, this informs the work, and gives you that concise ability to inspire action and say, this is how I'm informed and how I'm going to lead this work going forward. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you approach that. You know, and I can say from a certain perspective, you know, being Native, both of us, it's that we approach it very differently than someone who's not Indigenous, right? Like we approach this work from that very relatable perspective, right? This is our people. This is why our lives are the way they are in some ways, right? This happened to us and it's still happening to us. I'm wondering if you could just talk about that a little bit, you know, how you approach the work in a meaningful and sensitive way, but also in a truthful and honest way, because that's what's most effective at informing people.
Yeah, for sure. Gosh, I appreciate that perspective too, you know, and I think I do bring in a lot of that, you know, ancestry, a lot of that sort of like indigenous teaching and knowledge and culture, and really wanting storytelling to be like a big part of that. And I think that that sort of like helps drive a narrative that's a little bit more intentional, a little bit more creative, in the sense of like we're exploring heavy topics on a deeper level, maybe on a level that maybe some folks outside of our communities don't often explore such heavy topics. And I think that being able to deal with something as all-encompassing is like settler colonialism that like is still happening and represents just like literal mass atrocities can just be so daunting, you know? Like, how do you break that apart? How do you talk about it? How do you plan around it? Like, how do you plan to do something different? How do you decolonize? Like, how do you do those actions to start break it apart? And I think My approach is very much so through an indigenous lens, and I'll even bring in that quote from Willie Littlechild, where it's talking about really sort of the four components of reconciliation, which is awareness of the past, acknowledgement of the harm, atonement for the causes, and action to change the behavior. And so that's really how I try to approach that work, is to like, let's talk about the past, let's not shy away from it. Let's have a full, holistic awareness of really what happened. And, you know, it's there. It's all around us. You know, it's reflected. The true stories are not in our history books, but it's reflected there in the parameter. And I think that folks can see that. And so really like calling an awareness to it helps us sort of level set and have that foundation of like really knowing what more was taking place, not what just was told to us. And then that, of course, allows us to acknowledge what happened. And I find, you know, I'll use I statements. Sometimes it's really easy to conform. It's easy to fall into colonial systems. It's easy to think of resources and wealth and money as finite. And if I don't grab it and do the thing that like white supremacy tells me to do, or capitalism tells me to do, or colonialism tells me to do, then I won't ever have it. And I want to live a fun, free, joyful life. So maybe I just conform to it and like do the thing. And I think that that can be a really, for me, I'll use I statements, easy trap that I can sometimes fall into. So having that awareness plus that acknowledgement of it, I think sort of prevents us from sort of repeating the cycle. And I think a big part of then what we need to do as Indigenous folks is like put that in front of people, have there be an atonement, like don't shy away from this, like make sure that folks know it and see it, because that's the only way that we're going to get to that final stage of like having action. And so, you know, that's how I really try to break it down, is within that framework of awareness, acknowledgement, atonement to get to action. And I think too, there's an element where it just feels like it's so much, right? Like when we look at systemic oppression, I mean, I see it all around me. I experience it all around me, and it just feels so daunting. Like, how do you stop it? How do you turn it off? And I think starting small and doing that internal look, doing that internal lens, and starting to like pick apart those pieces, I think is the start of the process. And then us coming together and doing it collectively, I think really helps take it to the next level. So that's sort of how I approached my thinking to really dealing with like heavy subjects. And again, wrapping that in a pretty little bow that is storytelling, that is that interpersonal sort of connectiveness, and not like a very monotone, detached, I'm reading facts from a history book. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's certainly my approach.
No, I think that that makes a ton of sense. And, you know, there's a couple different points there that I just want to note, because I think they're really important. One is that I notice in your approach to this work, and I think I commented on this before, it's very recursive, right? It's very, you're tying back in these like very small moments that break down the idea so that they're digestible for the audience to say, this is very much a huge topic. Settler colonialism, you could do a PhD on, you know,
yeah,
you spend the rest
sure.
of your life
people do.
Studying it. Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. Lots of people do. And they still don't fully understand it. And yeah. It's one of those things where, you know, tying in these smaller bits of examples in history, it's very much in the same vein as incorporating something like the SIEO model,
yeah.
right? Like you're bringing in these abilities for people, these conceptualizing tools to say, this is the heavy topic, this is the huge topic that you may be unfamiliar with, or maybe you're very familiar with, but there's a methodology here to approach it where you can understand it in this more tangible, tethered way to reality, right? It's not just this armchair academic subject matter,
yeah.
right? It's not just something that is a hypothetical scenario, right? It's not in a vacuum. And I think that, again, you know, tying back into our conversation in the beginning a little bit, bringing that lived experience allows you to champion that and say, I experienced this. And a lot yeah. of the times, Indigenous people in the work of, you know, kind of decolonizing and bringing up truth-telling in general, we have to recognize that most people aren't taught about the lead-up of where we are and how we are societally,
yeah.
right? And for Indigenous youth in particular, I feel that it's hard. It's a hard truth that they are not equipped, writ large, with the knowledge of colonization, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's no handbook to this is what has happened to your people. It's different, right? It's a diaspora.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, person to person, tribe to tribe, nation to nation, right? It's very, very different. There are common threads there. And I think the humanizing approach you take to this work very much centers that lived experience and says, you know, this is the background, this is the context setting that you need to understand to approach this work. And for us at the center, you know, making these tools for people working in tribal child welfare, I think it's important because, again, there's so many parallel points that tie back in. And I love how recursive it is. It's just that, you know, again, most Indigenous people working in these capacities, I would say, have a fundamental knowledge of decolonization and colonization of what those topics are, how they incorporate into our work, right? It's a little bit inherent in this work for Native people doing work with Native tribes, you know, that whole thing. But we can't let that get in the way of understanding it at a deeper level, a more contextual level to work that is, you know, a part of this, like in this webinar series. Like the way you approach tying that in is so good. And I think that it's really powerful because you don't want to take a passive approach to decolonization, right? You don't want to say, oh, yeah, decolonization is X, Y, and Z, and, you know, here we go. I like how you make it active and you apply it directly to a use case for this work. And I think it's really impactful in that way.
Yeah. I think in a way, what we're really talking about is like an attachment. Mm. You know, I feel like with any subject, I think whether you're Indigenous or not, right, if we just take colonization, you know, it's about your attachment to that subject. And I think to your point, a large part of what I'm trying to do is attach you to that subject, is to actually not only attach you to it, but actually see yourself a part of that story, because you are. You are a literal part of that history. You're a little literal part of the present of that history, and you're a literal part of continuing that history forward into the future. And so I think if we can see ourselves in the topic, in the subject, in the narrative, if we can see ourselves as part of the stories, I think it's harder to turn away from it and easier to turn into it and to attach yourself and to own it and to try to do those action items, even if it's just selfish, even if it's just to like your own benefit, you know, like, I think that's a big part of it is folks need to see themselves as a part of this history because they are, no matter where you are, like you said, on sort of the diaspora, right? Mm. Like you are a part of this. And so you need to own it. So yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up.
The concept of history is happening every day, right? Like every day is another page turning in the book. And I think that whether it's intentional or not, I believe that the way we approach history, or the way that we're taught to approach history, is very much a, like I said kind of in the beginning, an othered thing, right? It's a past tense. It's not it's not now, right? It's then. And I think that that separates us cognitively, physically, you know, in every capacity. And I think that, like you said, making it reflective, implicating the self and saying, I'm a part of this history, you know, I'm helping write the book every day, is a really good approach, again, for that active work in this representative work, in this trans-affirming work, like in part one, right? Like, it's so important. And to be diligent and understand that you're a part of it, right? And it's liberating.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, Jared, I'm having this moment where it's almost like a full circle moment where it's coming back to my own entry point of this work, which is essentially like, you know, my history could write me, or I could write my own history.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's about that attachment, for better or for worse, to our stories, to our ancestries, to our teachings, to our histories, and in a way for Indigenous folks, to our oppression. Mm-hmm. And it's a way in which to say that can either continuously, as it has been in the past, be written for me, or I can start to take ownership of it and write that history myself. every day to make that the thing that I utilize to make my life and my family's life and my loved one's life and Indigenous youth and everybody on this planet just a little bit better by trying to take control of that narrative, of that history, and own it in new and exciting ways that, you know, haven't been told intentionally because it hasn't been written for us. You know what I mean? It has been written for us. And so I really like that sort of perspective of like that history is being written and we could either be a part of it or not. And it's, I think, a lot better for us to be a part of it.
Oh, absolutely. Take an active role in that and empower yourself, right? Stand up for those that need it most. I feel like, you know, it's great.
Yeah.
That's it for this episode. If you'd like to hear the rest of this conversation, make sure to check out episode 2. And as always, you can find all of the resources mentioned in this conversation in the show notes below. Thanks.